This is Phil Farron, and I am driving home. It's Thursday today. It is episode 140. 140. Unbelievable. About 16 weeks here. I will have been doing this for 3 years. You know, one of the big problems that I have as an individual, someone asked me the other day, my phone is buzzing. Oh, this is my daughter. One moment. Hi, sweetie. It's going fine. You're actually kind of on the podcast. Oh, no, it's fine. What can I do for you? I'm just driving around the parking lot. I am headed home. Oh, okay. Oh, that's fine. That's fine. Why don't you call mom and see? I know she's rushing around and trying to get ready for her choir coming over. And so why don't you call? That is Saturday. So you might just call and see. I would just love to see Clara tonight, but I don't know what her schedule is like. So, sure. Okay, sure. Yeah. It's up to her. Okay, cool. See you, bye. I may have a chance to see my granddaughter this evening. Yay! Sorry about that. Something new for the podcast. I don't know that I've... Maybe I have. I don't take many phone calls. Anyways, I'm sure you heard the guy honking at me because I was thinking about Clara coming over and I was sitting at the light and the light changed and so... He was not happy that I was still sitting there, but it was nice of him to honk so that I would know that I should be going. Anyways, it's been a good week, been a busy week. I actually decided I would donate a little bit of time to my major client this week because I had already made budget and, you know, it was all fine. And I was a little farther behind on a project than I wanted to be. And so I thought, you know, let's just donate some hours and see if we can kind of get caught up here a little bit. And I'm presently working on putting Google Maps on this site I've been working on. And I've never done that before, aside from just really simple maps. And so I was thinking, okay, you know, you should probably climb your way up this tree and learn this. So I'll probably go in tomorrow for a little bit, probably on Saturday a little bit. Maybe, if everything goes well, I might be able to get this working, which would be cool, because it would be a huge add to the site. So, anyways, that all goes well. Everything seems to be fine there. Obviously, I'd like to be completely done with the project already, since I am at the deadline hours that I had set. But, you know, sometimes things get more complicated in the mix, and this project certainly has gotten more complicated in the mix. Whoa. I've got somebody who is really interested in hurrying around, and there's someone else really interested in hurrying around. So, okay, now we seem to be good. Just people and... Oh, no. Oh, they're going into the gas station, not turning left. Okay. Anyways, so all is well there. This past week, week before last, I sat down and read a book that my parents-in-law had given me for my birthday in November. And it was an interesting book, especially chapter one of the book was pretty interesting. And this is going to be actually interesting for me because I'm losing my light. I'm not used to things getting so dark so fast. So I actually am losing my light here a little bit, and I don't think I have any of those little, I'm checking, I don't think I have any of those little handy dandy light thingies in this car, because this is a very low budget car. So we're going to do our best to try to glance at the notes every once in a while and see what we've got to talk about. The name of this book was I Never Thought I'd See the Day, and it's by a man named Dr. David Jeremiah. You know, I'm out of the loop, so, but apparently he's, you know, written lots of books and yada yada. But the book itself had some interesting things to say, and specifically the first chapter. And specifically the first chapter was about, I'd never thought I'd see the day when atheists would be angry. Apparently, atheists are angry at this point. And in the process of him talking about atheists being angry, there was some pretty interesting little stuff. I don't spend a whole lot of time in Christian apologetics. There was a time in my life when I thought it was really important to know all the arguments so that if I met somebody, I could argue with them, you know. But I have changed my position on that. And I will get to the final position by the time I get home. And it's something I've talked to several friends about this week. But that's not to say that there can't be some interesting observations. Certainly when there are accusations or claims that are made, you know, if you want to have something to respond with, that's fine. A lot of my responses now are well, I hope that works out for you. Go, be at peace. Exercise your free will. Do what you want. But nonetheless, some of these things are interesting, and I just bring them to you as a way of saying, oh, this is interesting. So apparently the atheists are angry. He was quoting some big atheist as saying they had this convention and the emotions ran the gamut from should we, you know, take a sledgehammer to religion or just a baseball bat. I mean, that they're really angry and they want to change something. And so they're trying to figure out why can't we get more people interested in atheism? And one of the things they did, a couple of the famous atheists, and I would tell you their names, but I'm losing the light, so I'm just going to have to do this by memory. One of the things they did is they decided that they needed a new name. So they came up with this new name. Oh, I missed a spot. Hold up. So being angry. And there was a commentator who made a very interesting observation about atheists being angry at God. And his observation was that he has shaken his fist at a lot of things. You know, he's cursed the chairs, he's shaken his fist at cars and storm clouds and incompetent meteorologists, blah, 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 blah. But he's never shaken his fist at a unicorn. And the reason he's never got mad at a unicorn is because he doesn't believe the unicorn exists. And yet he says it seems like there's a whole lot of atheists that are mad at God. So that was an interesting observation. The other thing was, is that in 2003, Daniel Dennett decided that atheists needed a new name. That if they didn't call themselves atheists, maybe they could get more people involved in their cause. And so they decided that their new name would be Bright. That a Bright was one who holds a materialistic worldview. And I'm actually stopped at a stoplight, so maybe I can read you some of this. I actually got tickled. Steve Waldman responded in an NPR commentary this way. I'm not sure what the image buffers were aiming for, but the name The Brights conveys the sense that this group thinks they're smarter than anyone else. He said, that would apparently make the rest of us the Dims. And he said, you might as well name yourselves the Smugs or the Smarty Pants. And his basic point was, you have chosen a name that's just going to tick everybody off, aside from the fact that it's not very accurate. And this is where things started getting interesting for me in this little speech, because he said there had been some polls, Gallup polls and Harris polls, on people's belief in the supernatural, specifically with individuals who had postgraduate degrees. Doctors, lawyers, dentists, blah, 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 blah. Okay? Some very interesting statistics. 55% believe in the devil. 53% believe in hell. 72% believe in miracles. 87% believe that the soul survives after death. Coming up to another stoplight, so I may be able to read smarter. 60% believe in the virgin birth, and 64% believe in the resurrection of Christ. 64% of people with postgraduate degrees believe in the resurrection of Jesus Christ. So perhaps the brights is not the best nomenclature to adopt when the majority of the people, according to that nomenclature, would be considered the dims. So anyway, I thought that was interesting. It was interesting at all as well because he was talking about the fact that atheists often say, well, to be fair, sure, you take credit for the fact that there's great charities around the world and that religion has done some great things, but, you know, if you're going to take credit for that, you really have to take credit for all the atrocities that have been committed by people in the name of religion. And he quoted a guy in this book that had a kind of an interesting perspective on that. And he said that is that this guy he was quoting, his perspective was that claiming that Christianity had to take credit for the people who did not behave in a Christian way and still claim to be Christians would be the same as a professor having to take equal credit for those who came into his class as good students, who worked hard, who applied themselves, who learned the material and lived by the material, and then went out and became successes in life. Surely that professor would have the right to take credit for those students. But what this claim that Christianity must take credit for both the good and the bad says, that that same professor must then take credit for the slacker who gets kicked out after 2 weeks, who doesn't know the material and has flunked all the tests. And since he can't make a go of that information he supposedly was learning in this class that he never paid attention to and rarely attended and mostly slept through, then the professor must then take credit for the fact that this guy is not a success in life. And of course we would say, well, that's ridiculous. You can only take credit for people who actually work the system and apply the system. And the same thing is true for religion. Honestly, we do have terrorists that are running around claiming to be Muslims. But the Islam that they are practicing is not one that even a lot of the good Islams would claim. It's always interesting to me to read about these terrorists, how that they're getting ready to sacrifice their life in some grand thing, and yet when they come to America, a lot of them, they hit the strip bars because so they're in there watching strippers and stuff because that's their holy duty, I guess, before they sacrifice themselves. So just like we in Christianity don't need to claim credit for the bozos, frankly, that are out there that don't really understand the gospel or apply the gospel to their lives, I don't think we should force Islam to take credit for the radical terrorists either. Now, Islam and what it teaches and all those things. That's a whole other topic. But I think there's a good point that it's a good analogy to say that the professor really only needs to take credit for the students who have applied themselves. So I thought that was good. There was another interesting point, because you hear about this all the time, and that is about the typewriting monkeys. So, and what you hear about is, well, if you have enough monkeys that are all banging on typewriters, that eventually they'll produce a sonnet. And they mentioned that there was actually a study done where they took a computer and they put it inside a cage. I think they said with 6 monkeys. I can't really see my notes. So, said with like 6 monkeys. And I think they left it in there for a month and just let the monkeys bang away on it. They said in that month, the monkeys did manage to produce 50 pages of stuff. Not surprisingly, though, the monkeys did not produce one single word. Not one single word. Now, you may be thinking, how can that be? We have words that are only one letter. So obviously, at some point, the monkeys would have typed that one letter. In fact, the only reason that the letter I and the letter A are words is because they have a space before them and after them. So even the simplest word that we have, AI, and some would say O, those words have to be bounded by delimiters that are used in an intelligent way. And the monkeys banging away on the computer never produced a single word for a month. I don't know if it was based on this or based on some other information, but he does quote another article by a research scientist, I think, in Israel, that actually ran the numbers to see this claim that everybody makes, that if you had enough typewriters and enough monkeys banging away on them, that eventually they would produce a sonnet like Shakespeare, because infinity produces everything. We've learned that from listening to several scientists on the multiverse, which we're probably going to talk about the multiverse next week again, because there was a Nova program on the multiverse and I was making notes. It's really interesting how infinity becomes our new God, because infinity creates everything. Anyways, so this scientist, I can't look at my notes, I will try to reproduce it fairly accurately, said, if you could fill our entire universe with tiny computing machines, and he had, I forget what the size of the machine is, but it was very small, very, very small. And he said, these machines could try out, it was something like, it was over 400 random combinations of letters. And they could do that 1,000,000 times a second. And you could fill the entire space of the known universe with these tiny machines. Just pack it tight, where every single one of them is trying over 400 combinations, or maybe it's 400 random letters, and it's doing it 1,000,000 times a second. According to his calculations, you would never, never produce a sonnet. Never. Because sonnets require intelligence. It requires the artful arranging of things. No one who reads a sonnet would say, oh, that just happened. And I am digressing at this point. because I'm not far from home, and I can't see my notes. So, one of the interesting things about something that is recognizable as intelligence, as I was saying, that anybody who reads a sonnet recognizes that it is the product of some intelligence. Even computers that write little poetry, okay, that is being done by a program. It's not just spewing out random letters. You actually have someone and a database, have someone that put together an algorithm, have someone that created a database of words. There is intelligence there. I remember my wife and I going out, I think it was for our 20th anniversary. We went out to California.
And one of the things that we did was
we were in the vicinity of Pebble Beach, the famed Pebble Beach golf course, the famed housing development, Pebble Beach. And we had paid to take the little tour. And we drove down to the spot that was the reason it is called Pebble Beach. And that is, there are all these flat, round stones, pebbles, and people play with them down on the beach. And one of the things they do is stack them up. And as soon as we pulled in the car and got out and started walking towards it, I thought, ah, immediately, that's a sign of intelligence. Someone stacked these things up in a meaningful way. The wind did not just blow and hurtle them this way. There wasn't an earthquake that bounced them all up. You looked at it and you saw that there was intelligence. Because it was obvious that that just didn't happen in nature. And it's the same thing with the sonnet on the computer program. Okay, let me grab a quick look at my notes. See, normally I could turn on the light in the car at this point, but my lights burned out. So, let's see. According to this guy, oh, this was very interesting. Let me just pull into the garage and read this to you. This was very interesting. And I think it's a welcome introduction in that atheists are actually willing to say this now, because they hadn't been up to this point. Years ago, when I still thought it was important for me to try to argue the points of Christian apologetics, I was talking to some people about objectivism and subjectivism and saying how that we are all subjective. And I was trying to explain why we were all subjective. And I said, I'm subjective. And I had a guy who was trying to say that he was objective. And his response was, well, you're subjective, so you're biased, so you can't tell what's objective or not, so you can't even comment on this. What? But anyways, so what's really interesting about this is that up till the time I read this quote, the typical response from materialists, from people who said that naturalism is all there is, their typical response was, I only believe in what I can see, touch, taste, smell, what I can investigate, what is in this world. That's all I believe. I don't believe in anything else. Well, what is fascinating about this quote out of this book is that, not quite in far enough. What is fascinating about the quote in this book is that, you know, this guy, he just comes flat out and says, absolutely, yes, we are subjective. Absolutely, we have some core beliefs that we latch onto and that we hold to fiercely. So let me find the quote, because this is really good. I have my little flashlight here that I will shine on my paper. Okay, here we go. Atheists admit that their propositions are based on belief. Richard Lewotin, Richard Lewotin, I'm sorry, I don't know how his name is pronounced, says, our willingness to accept scientific claims that are against common sense is the key to an understanding of the real struggle between science and the supernatural. We take the side of science in spite of the patent absurdity of some of its constructs. Inspired by its failure to fulfill many of its extravagant promises of health and life, in spite of the tolerance of the scientific community for unsubstantiated, just-so stories, because we have an a priori commitment, a commitment to materialism. It is not that the methods and institutions of science somehow compel us to accept a material explanation of the phenomenal world, but on the contrary, we are forced by our a priori adherence to material causes to create an apparatus of investigation and a set of concepts that produce material explanations, no matter how counterintuitive, no matter how mystifying to the uninitiated. Moreover, that materialism is absolute, for we cannot allow a defined foot in the door. That's pretty interesting. Also, one of the other interesting things is the author was talking about how many times a crisis of faith, when people move away from the gospel, is then followed by a crisis of doubt. C.S. Lewis became a convert in part because he had a friend who was the hardest, hard-boiled atheist he knew. And yet he was assailed by fears that the evidence for God was so good that he might actually exist. Lewis wrote that if this man, the cynic of cynics, the toughest of toughs, were not, as I would still have put it, safe, where could I turn? Was there no escape? In other words, he's saying, this guy is really struggling hard to be an atheist, and yet there's so many things around him that are drawing him that finally he gave up and caved in. And when C.S. Lewis saw that happen, then he thought, oh, man, you know, how am I ever going to sustain this disbelief? The other thing that is interesting at the end of this chapter is the fact that atheists are coming out and actually saying that if they're going to be honest about it, that they need to acknowledge that religion has had some benefit. And there's a big, long quote, but this was really interesting. This is from John D. Steinrucken. He wrote a 2010 article for the American Thinker entitled Secular's Ongoing Debt to Christianity. And this is what he said in that article. It is rational to conclude that religious faith made possible the advancement of Western civilization. That is, the glue that has held Western civilization together over the centuries is the Judeo-Christian tradition. To the extent that the West loses its religious faith in favor of non-judgmental secularism, then to the same extent, it loses that which holds all else together. Although I am a secularist, an atheist, if you will, I accept that the great majority of people would be morally and spiritually lost without religion. Can anyone seriously argue that crime and debauchery are not held in check by religion? It is not comforting to live in a community where the rule of law and is it not comforting to live in a community where the rule of law and fairness are respected? Would such be likely if Christianity were not there to provide a moral compass to the great majority? Do we secularists not benefit out of all proportion from a morally responsible society? An orderly society is dependent on a generally accepted morality. There can be no such morality without religion. Has there ever been a more perfect and concise moral code than the one Moses brought down from the mountain? Those who doubt the effect of religion on morality should seriously ask the question, just what are the immutable moral laws of secularism? Be prepared to answer, if you are honest, that such laws simply do not exist. The best answer we can ever hear from secularists to this question is a hodgepodge of strained relativistic talk of situational ethics. They cite no overriding authority other than that of fashion. For the great majority in the West, it is the Judeo-Christian tradition which offers a template assuring a life of inner peace towards the world at large, a peace which translates to a workable, liberal society. Okay, that's pretty interesting. So, I say all this stuff, why? Am I interested in putting it on placards and standing out on a corner and saying, see, you atheists are wrong? No, I am not interested in that. I'm not interested in that at all. I say all this to say, we need to recognize that God is constantly calling people, that he's constantly drawing people to himself. I thought it was so interesting to read about C.S. Lewis and about how the crisis of faith is sometimes followed by the crisis of doubt. Because I think that's going on in the hearts of all atheists. They may say, no, it's not. But you know what? Here's my strategy. My strategy is to love people, to get along with people, to work with people, to be the guy everybody wants on his team, to be the diligent guy, to be the guy who has a lot of good answers when there is need for an answer. And most of all, to be the guy who helps keep the door open as opposed to the guy who kicks the door shut. And if you're standing on a street corner with a sign that says, if you don't believe in Jesus, you're going to hell, you're kicking the door shut. And so I feel like my job in life is just to be calm water, as the Tao would say. You know, just to find whatever nooks and crannies that I can in a relationship with someone who doesn't believe in God and fill up those nooks and crannies and be ready and just draw them to the love of Christ. And after they spend time around me, what I want is for their awareness of the Spirit to be enhanced, not for their awareness of the flesh to be enhanced. And if I am being a kind, generous, thoughtful, intelligent, creative person around them, and encouraging them to be the same, all that's going to do is give them a deeper opportunity to hear the Spirit, because he's working on them and calling them. And he will eventually get through to them. You know, unless they just really absolutely, you know, do that kind of thing. But God is good. God just keeps working on us. And I really do want to cooperate with God in what he's trying to do with people, because he loves people and I love people too. This is Phil Ferrand, and I have made it home.